From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, May 14, 2009. Coming up in the next half hour, House Democrats debate on whether or not to approve Obama's war supplemental. The Senate debates legislation to restrict some credit card company practices, but capping interest rates is off the table.
When you look at some of these rates, in fact, rates as high as 32% in the credit card industry. And of course, when you get beyond the credit card industry and some other areas of lending, the numbers get exorbitant.
And we'll take you to Canada, where abortion was decriminalized 40 years ago today. But pro-choice activists say the fight continues.
It's personal, even if it's not me. And even if I never got an abortion, but I want that to be an option if I have to.
I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories and more. But first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Myanmar government has brought new charges against pro-democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi after an American man swam nearly a mile across a lake to her home, where she has been under house arrest for 6 years. Her detention was scheduled to end this month. The Myanmar government claims the Nobel Peace Laureate violated the terms of her detention by allowing the man to stay for 2 days in order to recover from the swim. The man was not pursued by authorities until he left her home, even though the grounds were heavily guarded. Today, police took Suu Kyi into custody. Her trial is scheduled to begin Monday. Hundreds of families are fleeing their home in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, today, as heavy and deadly fighting between the Somali government and Islamist forces continue. From Somalia, Abdurrahman Warsame reports.
Fighting claimed the lives of more than 100 people and wounded almost 400 more, according to a local human rights organization. Hundreds of families have left their homes in the unstable northern section of Mogadishu for other parts of the city. Some even opted to go back to camps for internally displaced people on the outskirts of the capital, where many spent the past 2 years escaping violence. The latest confrontations broke out last week after the Islamist Al-Shabaab movement accused Somali government forces of an assassination attempt on one of their senior commanders in Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab fighters and militants of the newly formed Hezbollah Islam have captured several key positions in Mogadishu. The allied insurgent forces control most of the south and center of Somalia and run nearly two-thirds of the capital. The UN envoy to Somalia has accused the hardline Islamist leader Sheikh Hassan Dareways of being behind the renewed fighting and trying to overthrow the fledgling Somali government. On Wednesday, Somali president officially instated Sharia law. Reporting for FSRN, this is Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
A class action lawsuit by residents of the Ivory Coast against multinational mineral company Trafigura may have new life today. The suit alleges that in 2006, a Trafigura-chartered tanker dumped toxic waste in the Ivory Coast city of Abidjan, killing six and making tens of thousands of people ill. The company has denied the claim, saying the ship did not contain any toxic material. But now the BBC has obtained analysis of the contents of the Trafigura ship, proving it contained approximately 2 tons of the deadly chemical hydrogen sulfide. In a statement, the company now blames the dumping on an independent contractor. Trafigura has also been accused of coercing witnesses. The case is scheduled to be heard in Great Britain in October. Two U.S. journalists are facing trial in North Korea for allegedly entering the country illegally, in addition to perpetrating what the government calls hostile acts. Yuna Lee and Laura Ling both work for Current TV and were captured near the Chinese-North Korean border in mid-March. Their trial is scheduled to begin on June 4th. Today, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi defended herself against allegations that she knew about the use of torture techniques being employed by the U.S. government as early as 2002.
The CIA briefed me only once on enhanced interrogation techniques in September 2002 in my capacity as ranking member of the Intelligence Committee. I was informed then that the Department of Justice opinions had concluded that the use of enhanced interrogation techniques were legal. The only mention of waterboarding at that briefing was that it was not being employed. Those conducting the briefing promised to inform the appropriate members of Congress if that technique were to be used in the future.
Pelosi went on to say that 5 months later, she was told by a member of her staff that the Republican and new Democratic leader of the Intelligence Committee were briefed that certain interrogation techniques were being employed. She said she was not privy to the details of that meeting. Pelosi says the ranking Democratic leader sent a letter of protest to the CIA General Counsel.
We also now know that techniques including waterboarding had already been employed and that those briefing me in September 2002 gave me inaccurate and incomplete information.
Pelosi denied she was complicit in the use of torture techniques and places culpability on the CIA.
Madam Speaker, just to be clear, you're accusing the CIA of lying to you in September of 2002.
Misleading the Congress of the United States.
Republicans initially accused Pelosi last week of knowing about harsh interrogation methods early on. Pelosi says Republicans are trying to distract the public and called for the creation of a truth commission to investigate allegations of torture. Former Idaho Attorney General Larry Echo Hawk was voted out of Senate committee today to lead the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Echo Hawk is a member of the Pawnee tribe, a Mormon, and currently a professor at Brigham Young University. His confirmation will likely go before the full Senate sometime next week. And finally, a correction. Yesterday, we reported about the U.S. gaining a seat on the U.N. Human Rights Council and stated there were 18 countries represented. There are actually 47. 18 were elected in the most recent round of voting. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Democrats in the House of Representatives debated each other today on the Hill as they considered President Obama's $94 billion supplemental for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As Karen Miller reports, some anti-war progressive Democrats are voting for the supplemental despite the fact it will not include an exit strategy.
The War Supplemental, also known as H.R. 2346, provides funds for troops, humanitarian aid, construction projects, and coalition forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. It also provides funds for projects that are not military-related, for example, HIV-AIDS grants and swine flu response programs. Progressive Caucus member and California Democrat Diane Watson says this year's war supplemental seems all too familiar.
The last administration never put the funds for the war in the regular budget. They always came as a supplement with all good things that we wanted in it. So you were forced to vote for it.
Watson, however, is not voting for the supplemental this time.
I am not voting for another cent for any war anywhere because we will never win a war in that part of the world, Iraq, even Iran, if we choose or chose to go to war there, Afghanistan, Pakistan. It can only be done through diplomacy, through negotiations, through politics, but never at the end of a gun.
Some progressives say they are voting for the massive spending bill. Congressional Black Caucus member and Illinois Representative Danny Davis.
There's no way that we cannot provide the resources that are necessary for our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's no way that we cannot provide the resources needed by our military, period.
But Davis adds a caveat.
But I really feel that this is kind of like the last of the Bush budgets in terms of funding military operations in Afghanistan and in Iraq. We've also been told that this will be the last time that we're going to be asked to provide a supplemental. I'm going to take the president at his word, and so I'm going to vote for the supplemental right now with the understanding that we still are trying our best to get out of both these theaters as quickly as humanely possible.
This week, the Congressional Progressive Caucus released a report stressing humanitarian aid to Afghanistan over military aid. This has some Republicans bristling. Daryl Issa, Republican from California.
So the people who never wanted to go to war, but who always want to send financial aid, tell me how we send financial aid to Afghanistan. Forgetting about the Taliban, forgetting about Al-Qaeda, what you have in Afghanistan is a country which cannot keep its borders and its interior safe from terrorists. More importantly, you have the greatest producer of heroin exiting into Europe and the rest of the world in large amounts. Those who say that we should not have our military there do not have an alternative to stabilize that country on behalf of not just the Afghan people, but the people of the region affected both by terrorism and drugs.
Issa says he's holding Obama to his word.
Well, it's very clear that without the supplemental, our troops in the field, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, are going to be at a strategic disadvantage, a tactical disadvantage to the enemy. So we need the money. I think particularly with the president's past statement that Afghanistan is the battlefield, he needs to put money where his mouth is.
The resolution also contains a provision that prohibits funds from the supplemental being used to release detainees from Guantanamo Bay into the U.S. Some Democrats are calling for President Obama to provide an exit strategy for forces in Afghanistan by the end of the year. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
The Senate is debating legislation that would rein in the abusive practices of credit card companies. The bill offers consumer protections by limiting when the company can raise an interest rate, would ban some marketing of credit cards to people under the age of 21, and would require credit card companies to lower interest rates for deserving customers. The bill is expected to pass the Senate, but one controversial provision, a cap on excessive interest, was handily defeated. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
It's not often that CEOs of major banks walk the halls of Congress unless they're summoned to testify. They usually leave the dirty work of influencing lawmakers to teams of well-paid lobbyists. But Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citibank, joined dozens of other lobbyists in a grand room just outside the Senate chamber during a crucial vote. The measure, by independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, would have placed a 15% cap on credit card interest rates and finance charges, which is also known as usury. The power of the banking lobby prevailed. Only one-third of the Senate was in support, all Democrats and one independent. Peter Garuccio is spokesperson for the American Bankers Association, the trade lobby that represents credit card companies.
When you impose a cap, you necessarily inhibit competition and reduce choices for consumers, which is never a good thing.
When you look at some of these rates, in fact, rates as high as 32% in the credit card industry. And of course, when you get beyond the credit card industry and some other areas of lending, the numbers get exorbitant.
Chris Dodd is chair of the Senate Banking Committee.
There used to be a time when you'd go to jail for rates that are being charged today.
Usury laws date back to biblical times, where excessive interest rates were deemed sinful and can be traced through the Roman Empire and medieval times until 1978. That's when the Supreme Court, in Marquette versus First Omaha Service Corp., ruled that individual state usury laws don't apply to residents of other states. So credit card companies moved their headquarters to states with no restrictions, like South Dakota and Delaware. It was the beginning of the end of caps on interest rates in the U.S. Sally Greenberg is executive director of the National Consumers League.
The rent-to-own companies that are charging people 200, 300, 400%, the payday loan industry, which charges upwards of 200 or 300% at times on different loans. Those are the kinds of out-of-control financial practices that have emerged over the last several decades, especially with the eradication of usury caps that used to exist in states all across the country but have been slowly repealed in state after state.
According to the think tank Demos, prior to 1978, 37 states had usury laws. Today, less than half do. Soon after, the federal government began chipping away at federal limits as well, creating loopholes to easily circumvent state regulations. What came next was more profit for banks and more debt for consumers. According to statistics from the Federal Reserve, in 1980, Americans had $58 billion of credit card debt. Less than 30 years later, at the end of last year, that number jumped to just under $1 trillion, an increase of nearly 2,000%. Ed Mierzwinski is with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
There's no question that even though the Federal Reserve is giving banks money at somewhere around 0% interest plus a few pennies, the banks are gouging us, the payday lenders are gouging us even more.
Some usury caps still exist, credit unions must abide by a 15% cap, and Congress passed a measure in 2005 that protected members of the military from excessive fees. Although the 15% cap for credit cards failed in the Senate, Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois said his proposal, which would cap usury at 36% for all loans, might get a shot later this year.
There were a number of my colleagues who came to me and said, what about your 36% usury rate? We can vote for that. So I'm not going to assume it's easy, but clearly there's an appetite among some members to bring up an issue which we haven't touched for decades.
The Senate will vote on the larger credit card bill as early as this week. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C. 40 years ago today, abortion was decriminalized in Canada. However, some pro-choice activists across that nation find themselves in a new struggle to safeguard the same rights that were guaranteed 4 decades ago. Some are also working to expand access to abortion in some provinces where it's restricted. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
McGill University, now a serene campus in the heart of downtown Montreal, was once an important battleground over control of women's bodies in Canada. In 1968, a group of McGill students who had founded the Montreal Health Press made waves when they published and distributed the Birth Control Handbook, back in a time when abortion was still a criminal act. Abby Lippman is a professor of medicine at McGill University and a member of the Canadian Women's Health Network.
And the birth control handbook here was really quite exciting because even giving information both in the United States and in Canada about birth control was illegal. You could not talk about it, and it just made no sense to many of us because, you know, if you didn't want to be pregnant, you didn't want, how did you avoid doing it? So what the students here did was quite courageous of them because they were doing something that was against the law by talking about it publicly.
This action and the public debate that it spurred led former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau to pass a Criminal Law Amendment Act, which provided for abortions in some cases when the woman's health was in danger and opened the floodgates for decriminalization. Another figure who is central to the battle to decriminalize abortion was Dr. Henry Morgenthaler. A Jewish immigrant from Poland and a Holocaust survivor, Morgenthaler had always been a staunch defender of social justice, especially for women. He publicly announced that he had been performing thousands of abortions for women at his now famous clinic in Montreal and would eventually face numerous jail sentences in the 1970s for his actions. In recent years, the Morgenthaler Clinic in Montreal has been the target of demonstrations from pro-life organizations such as Campagne Québec Vie, which held anti-abortion vigils to coincide with Lent this year. Pro-choice advocates in Canada are concerned that their fight is far from being over. Last year, the Conservative government introduced Bill C-484, or the Unborn Victims of Crime Act, which would have made it a separate offense to kill a pregnant woman. Some say passage of this bill could start a slippery slope by granting legal rights to the fetus, but Ken Epp, the former Conservative member of Parliament who drafted the bill, disagrees.
If some third party comes along with a fist or a boot or a knife or a sword or a gun, and says, I'm going to relieve you of your child that you want against your will with violence, then I would think that the pro-choice people would say, oops, we can't let that happen. That's somebody interfering with the woman's choice, so we better bring down the hammer on him.
Bill C-484 hasn't become law in Canada, but it is still on the Conservatives' agenda. Maëlle Lamoureux is an activist with the pro-choice feminist collective La Riposte, who organized Thursday's demonstration in Montreal. She says all Canadians should be concerned about attacks on abortion rights.
It's personal, even if it's not me. And even if I never got an abortion, but I want that to be an option if I have to. And I think that women shouldn't have to feel pressure from any person, whether it's their partner or the church or anyone. So I just think it's a matter of equality between men and women.
Coordinated demonstrations to demand greater access to abortion are taking place today in many Canadian cities, including Montreal, Toronto, and Ottawa. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
In Illinois today, Governor Pat Quinn is naming a new head to lead the Department of Corrections. The new chief will be charged with reviewing conditions at the state's Supermax prison, which has been the target of human rights groups. Ellen Pearson reports.
At the southern tip of Illinois sits the TAMS Correctional Center, the only remaining Supermax prison in Illinois. About 250 men are housed at TAMS in permanent solitary confinement. Prisoners have no communal activity, no phone calls, and no contact visits. They leave their cells for only two reasons: a weekly shower or solitary exercise in a concrete pen with no exercise equipment. Steven Eisenman is the author of The Abu Ghraib Effect. He says the structure of supermax prisons like TAMS is similar to that of camps in Guantanamo Bay.
The prisons in the United States that are called supermaxes are designed in almost the same way as the notorious camps 5 and 6 and perhaps the secret camp 7 at Guantanamo Bay. Indeed, the same architects designed all of those. And they're places of extreme isolation, double isolation, really. They're isolated from other prisoners, from the public, and even from the guards who control them. Doors are open and closed by remote control. And the consequences of this extreme isolation are psychologically devastating, even physiologically devastating.
Meanwhile, the Illinois Department of Corrections claims that TAMS is necessary for the Illinois prison system's, quote, most disruptive, violent, and problematic inmates. But others say TAMS often functions as a holding cell for the mentally ill. Jean Snyder litigated a suit on behalf of four mentally ill prisoners in TAMS. She agrees that some of the men sent there were disruptive, but she says that in many cases their behavior was caused by serious mental illness that should be treated instead of punished.
The thing is, if you don't screen vigorously for serious mental illness, you're going to get a lot of people who are seriously mentally ill because oftentimes, they're the people who act out. Mm-hmm. And so if you just go around, if the wardens at the prisons just look and say, hey, I'm going to send the five guys who drive me nuts, they're going to pick some seriously mentally ill inmates. And that's how folks were chosen in the beginning when they went to TAMS.
What's even worse to some prisoner rights advocates is that some inmates have been sent to TAMS with seemingly little cause. TAMS Year 10 is a group of activists, family members, and former prisoners that formed in response to the facility's 10th anniversary last year. They say men are transferred into the nation's most punitive conditions with no due process rights whatsoever. Rosa Fuentes' son, Jimmy Garcia, has been in TAMS for 4 years. She says before being transferred, he had no disciplinary tickets.
Out of the blue, one morning, they just came to him and they told him, get your things, we're moving you. And he says, there was no hearing. There was nothing that he could do. All he knew was that they had put him in a van and he was driving and further away from Chicago. He says, my heart sank because I knew that I was being taken far away from my loved ones.
Another TAMS inmate is Norman Campbell. His mother, Teresa Phillips, says the same thing happened to him.
He had a perfect record, no tickets at Menard. He was on his way to Lawrenceville to a medium security prison. As he got there, they had a van waiting for him. They put him in the van and sent him to TAMS with no reason why. We are still waiting for him to get out, and it's been 4 years later.
TAMS Year 10 has taken their fight to the Illinois House of Representatives. The group has been working with lawmakers to draft a bill that would mandate clear and transparent criteria for transferring prisoners. The bill would also limit inmate time in solitary confinement and would prohibit mentally ill prisoners from being housed at TAMS. Illinois Representative Julie Hamus sponsored the bill.
Well, I think for many legislators, they understand that we should not keep prisoners locked up 23 hours a day. And I think they understand that, but politically, it's challenging because it looks like they're somehow helping prisoners if they vote yes on a bill like this. Mm-hmm. So they're torn between their own conscience and their own sense of what is basic values in America versus what is politically expedient. And sometimes that is a big challenge, especially when it comes to criminal justice issues.
Both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have endorsed the bill. Currently, it has 27 co-sponsors, almost half the number needed to pass. But in order for the bill to move forward, it must be called for a vote before the House ends its session at the end of the month. Ellen Pearson, FSRN.
This Memorial Day, tune in to Free Speech Radio News for a special documentary.
I thought when I came home that things was going to be easier because I served my country. Things was worse.
When you say the word homeless, they're like, ew, you know, and it's like, oh, I'll never do that. My thing is never say never because I was making a good living.
As record numbers of women return from active duty, the number of homeless female veterans is at an all-time high.
Serving in the military honorably and coming out honorably discharged and winding up homeless makes no sense to me.
Women veterans speak out about the challenges of returning to civilian life. That's Memorial Day, the 25th of May on FSRN. And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
A party of one. That great observer of American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, noted that political parties were like warring nations. While that's certainly true when it comes to rank-and-file members who work, sweat, bite, and fight against their political opponents for ascendancy, the same cannot be said of members at the highest levels. That is but one lesson to emerge from the abrupt party switch of U.S. Senator Arlen Specter, who up until quite recently was the senior Republican senator from Pennsylvania and among the institution's longest serving. Facing an increasingly difficult primary in the fall, he ditched the party on which he has run and won as a senator for almost 30 years and cast his lot with the majority party, the Democrats. Political pundits and talking heads went apoplectic in their overheated responses and predictions. Earth-shattering, said one. An earthquake, said another. In moments, they counted his votes on Democratic bills and proposals that hadn't even been written yet. The truth was quite simple. He wanted to win re-election, and he couldn't do it in the GOP. To be sure, some will gain and some will lose with this change. It's often been said that the Senate was a millionaire's club, but it's more. It's 100 men and women who are princes and princesses of power. Only two people are eligible in each state, and once in, it's difficult to lose. Richard J. Needham said, power is a drug on which the politicians are hooked. Power. There it is. The great wit Alexander Pope said, party spirit, which at best is but the madness of many for the gain of the few. To be sure, some will gain and some will lose with this change, but few will gain as much as the distinguished senator. Arlen Specter is a party unto himself. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. We're supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.